Can you not hear me?
I can hear you now. It was on my side, sorry.
Is it all right?
It's okay now.
Okay, let me try going back to the other. Ah, that's not what I wanted. That's better. Okay, let's go with that. It's a little delayed, but I don't think it's really disconcerting.
I don't think it's delayed. It looks okay, at least on my side.
Okay. Now I guess I could move this over. No, I don't want to move it over. That's right. I want to be looking here. Does that look all right to you? With me
Maybe just
looking right here?
half a step to the right.
Well, I don't know which way is right, that one,
Okay,
right?
okay, and now a little bit back, and that should be all.
Okay. The way I have things set up, let's see if I can turn off the lights. Me turn off my phone. Well, it is turned off, okay. I'm not gonna turn off that other light. Okay, I'm now, this is how it would be. How is that?
That looks good.
Okay, good. The glasses are not getting reflections now.
No.
Right. And let me move this over here. Good. Okay. I'm ready. It's 4:01. Let's get started.
Okay, I'm counting you down. 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to HBTV. I'm Harry Binswanger, the HB in HBTV. Today we're taking up a philosophy from ancient Greece that has been experiencing a revival recently. Some people think that's a good thing. I think it's a very bad thing. That philosophy is Stoicism. Stoicism is one of many death-worshipping philosophies. It does not worship death quite so openly as, say, Christianity. But it led to Christianity because it rejected life. It claimed that life was the source of all troubles, which in a way it is. If you're dead, you have no trouble. Its focus was entirely on the negative. Objectivism, Ayn Rand's philosophy, stresses the positive, motivation by love, the values that are available waiting for you to be achieved in this world. The essence of objectivism is that it's a pro-life philosophy. God, I don't mean it in the abortion sense. It is a pro-survival, flourishing, happy life philosophy. The essence of it is held in that exchange that many of you have read between two characters in Ayn Rand's first novel, We the Living. The heroine of the novel is Kira, and she's talking to a mistaken good guy, a communist who is a communist for all the best reasons there could be, not for the usual ones. He's kind of an imaginary communist. What would a communist be if his motivation were good instead of evil? His name is Andrei. Kira says to Andrei, "Do you believe in God, Andrei?" "No." "Neither do I. But that's a favorite question of mine, an upside down question, you know." "What do you mean?" Well, if I ask people whether they believed in life, they never understand what I meant. It's a bad question. It can mean so much that it really means nothing. So I ask them if they believe in God. And if they say they do, then I know they don't believe in life. Why? Because you see, God, or whatever anyone chooses to call God, is one's highest conception of the highest possible. And whoever places his highest conception above his own possibility thinks very little of himself and his life. It's a rare gift, you know, to feel reverence for your own life. And to want the best, the greatest, the highest possible here, now, for your very own. To imagine a heaven and then not to dream of it, but to demand it. Close quote from Read the Living. That is a rare gift indeed, and it's very rare in the history of philosophy. Most philosophies have been premised on not just God, but the highest possible is not possible to you. The highest conception of the highest possible is not possible for you to achieve. Nothing is perfect in this world. Life is sorrow, life is vexation, life is suffering. Bear up as best you can, or throw away your life and enter a monastery. Devote yourself to saving the whales, some self-denying, life-denying possibility or avenue for you. Most philosophies throughout history have turned away from life. Ayn Rand sees philosophies as life-affirming or life-negating. Hers was the supreme life-affirming philosophy. The Stoics are life negating, and the other ones I mentioned, the Christians and the Freudians and the climate don't changers, save the planet guys, they're all life denying. Ayn Rand sees life or death as the fundamental alternative. That's the basis of her ethics. There's that which is proper to life, and that's the good. And there's that which tends to destroy it, and that's bad. That's evil if it's chosen, if it's a matter of volitional choice. It's destruction is wrong. It's bad. It's evil. It's immoral if you to choose that. The good is that which promotes the achievement of values, the greatest possible happiness, success, and we will see that that's denied by all, unfortunately, all the people I'm going to discuss today. The Stoics were all about salvation. They came in ancient Greece after Aristotle. Aristotle did not catch on. He was well known, he was admired, people came to his lectures, but probably because he did not have a very inspiring ethical philosophy, it did not reach Greek culture. Plato did. And the Stoics are in the tradition of the anti-Aristotelians who followed Aristotle. They're a little influenced by Aristotle, but in general, they are Platonists. They are against this world. They believe that your lot is assigned to you. They're strict determinists. Aristotle upheld free will. Plato was, by implication, a determinist. But they are determinists, that is, a person who believes that everything that happens had to happen. Couldn't have been any different way. They're the determinists of a new kind. They appear in the Hellenistic era after some science had been achieved. Euclid had come and the guy who said Eureka, whose name just in a senior moment escapes me, who did many fascinating discoveries. He discovered the law of buoyancy. That's what he found. A body submerged in water displaces its own volume in water. A body floating on water displaces its own weight in water. Archimedes. And he discovered the principle of the lever. Not that people did not know about levers, but he formalized it in mathematical terms. The work done, the weight that can be lifted is proportional to the distance from the fulcrum that the pressure is applied. So, after science had achieved some success in codifying or naming the laws of the universe, not anything like it was to achieve in the Renaissance, but much more than it had ever come before, the determinists became scientific or pseudo-scientific. And the Stoics believed that everything that happened in the universe was determined by strict causality, scientifically ascertainable cause and effect that did not allow for any deviation from what the nature of the entities require that happen. If a stone rolls down a hillside, the next stone put in the same place and dropped in the same way will do the same thing if it's really equivalent. So it's much more modern in its determinism. It was not fatalism, though the gods have us in their grip of power and they do with us what they want, not what we want. They did hold something like that, but it was through natural law, through scientific discoverable law that everything that happens had to happen. Now, that's fine about inanimate matter. It's great. Inanimate matter does do what it has to do. But it's not fine about consciousness, particularly about conceptual thinking, human consciousness. Our thinking is not like a stone falling down a hillside. We control it. Consciousness can be self-conscious. We can and should control the operations of our abstract, conceptual, intellectual faculty, reason. But that was not known at this time. And the thought was that man is just like the stone falling down the hill. And behind it all, because they weren't mechanists like later Cartesians and modern scientists, behind it all is God's plan. God creates natural law, and everything that happens is part of God's plan. So human beings do not have choice. This led, along with their epistemology, to what Ayn Rand called a malevolent universe. That is, they viewed the evil as powerful, the bad, the destructive, as inevitable, human beings as unable to live happily and successfully. Everything that happens happens for a reason. And behind it all is God's plan operating through natural law. If you understand this, they said, then you don't get upset about anything. And that is where salvation lies. So, to troubled souls, which is what they had in this period of post-Hellenistic philosophy, Hellenistic and post-Hellenistic, to trouble souls, the idea of peace, of release from toil and suffering held in attraction. And that's what the Stoics preach. Augustine was the next major thinker. He was the, of course, founder of Christianity, the intellectual founder. If there was a Jesus, he didn't have doctrines. It was Paul and Augustine that worked out the really theology of Christianity. And Augustine said, man is crooked, sordid, ulcerous, and bespotted. If that's the nature of man, then what does life have to offer you? Nothing. Any success, any happiness, any wealth that you should acquire and try to enjoy is an illusion. You won't enjoy it. You'll lose it. You'll get sick. God will punish you. Things stink. The way to inner peace is to realize I can't do anything about it. Nothing matters. Give up. Don't care about anything. Because your emotions, your passions, as they called it, are the source of the problem. It's not the events of the world that cause you to suffer. It's your emotional life. So just get over it. Nothing matters. Don't care. Give up. In other words, kill yourself. But they didn't take that step. They didn't advocate actual physical suicide, but they advocated mental suicide, emotional suicide. The Christians took this and ran with it. Salvation became even more difficult to achieve because you couldn't do it on your own. But before I get there, I realize there's a term I should mention. The Stoic ethics advocated apathy. And that's similar to our concept of not caring. But it really means no passions. It was non-passion was their ethics. Don't care about anything because you can't do anything about it. It's all part of God's plan. So accept. And the three virtues of Stoic ethics were acceptance, which means realize you can't do anything. You're helpless. And discipline, which is shut off your damn emotions, which realizing you can't do anything about stuff will do for you. But anything else you can do is good. And a kind of duty to mankind. It's not exactly altruism, it's more collectivism. God put mankind here for a reason. Everything that happens is part of God's plan. Do your part, obey. Do your part in God's plan. Now, they didn't have a Bible to tell you what his plan was, so I don't know how that ever translated into anything. And it's not for that that they're influential. It's for the apathy, this the give up, nothing matters part. So that, of course, led to the fall of civilization and the Dark Ages. And it led to the Pope Innocent III, not so innocent, who wrote in 1203, happy are they who die before birth. And he wishes that he died in his mother's womb. Everything is woe, everything is vexation. If you think you're happy, you're a fool, you're not happy. Disaster's going to strike at any minute. So I have a couple of quotes because it's too juicy not to quote. In much wisdom, the Stoics wanted you to have wisdom. Be wise to know you can't do anything about it. Give up. In much wisdom is much vexation, much vexation. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Here's how it begins. This is on the misery of man. Why did I come forth from the womb to see toil and sorrow and spend my days in shame? That's a quote from the Bible. These are the words of the prophet who was sanctified by the Lord in his mother's womb. What should I say about myself, knowing that I was born in sin? Alas, I should say to my mother, why did you bear me, the son of bitterness and pain?
Sorry, I'm not sure about that.
Oh, someone here spoke, someone whose name cannot be pronounced because she's electronic and will answer to it. Why did I not die at birth, come forth from the womb and expire? Why did the knees receive me, or why the breasts that I should suck? Job 3. Why was I born, quote, destined as fuel for the fire? Isaiah 3:11. I wish I would have been killed in the womb, etc., etc. Verily, and this is the Pope again, after quoting those people, man has been formed of dust and has been conceived in sin, was born to punishment. In his actions, he is evil, disgraceful, and deceitful. He does what he ought not to do, whatever is shameful and not profitable to do. Man will become fuel for fire, the food of worms, a mass of putridity. It goes on and on. Oh, the supreme ugliness of sexual pleasure. As much as a man has, so much he has not, because he never takes pleasure in what he has, but always longs to acquire more. Now, if you think, well, that's the Dark Ages, that couldn't happen again. William James, at the turn of the century, an American, William James, the pragmatist, says, quote, the moral flabbiness born of the exclusive worship of the bitch goddess success, that is our national disease. And what is the whole environmentalist climate change movement other than we've got to stop wanting more. We've got to stop changing nature. We've got to stop making things different than they are in the state of nature. We've got to imitate and emulate the Native Americans who lived in harmony with their natural environment, i.e. lived in filth and died early with ravaged by diseases and killed each other in wars. So it's not just a medieval Dark Ages kind of viewpoint. It starts with the Stoics. It starts as a philosophical viewpoint. The earlier Greeks were optimistic. The earlier Greeks thought that life could be lived, and they wanted to live it. And the word for virtue in Greek, arete, means excellence. Means outstanding ability. And they would say the virtue of the flute player is to play the flute well. The virtue of the man is to live well. So they were positive, benevolent philosophers. The Stoics are the first ones who probably reacting to conditions that obtained at that time. Maybe not. certainly reinforcing them, if not leading them, counsel despair. Give up, don't care, steel yourself, do your duty, obey God's plan. So it was a small step downward to get to the Dark Ages. Let's jump ahead now, because I said I would talk about some other death-worshipping philosophers. You see why I call them death-worshipping? Life is a process of self-sustaining action. Life is the quest to achieve values. Life is action. It is motion towards goals, achieving goals, using goals to expand your range of action. It is success breeding success. It is like a profit-making business that seeks to reinvest its own profits and make even more profits. Death is the zero. In counseling, don't pursue anything. They are counseling death. They're holding death, non-achievement, non-action, non-valuing, non-caring as the value, it can't be a value because a value is a positive, as the proper attitude. Now there's a character, before I get to Freud and Save the Planet, there's a character in Ayn Rand's novels that I just realized in preparing this class is a Stoic. Can you think of who it is? Dominique Franken, until she changes. Here's the conversation that reveals the essence of why Dominique is a Stoic. She's talking to Alva Skarret, who is a co-worker on the newspaper. Alva Skarret says, "What do you want? Perfection?" She replies, "Or nothing." So you see, I take the nothing. I take the only desire one can really permit oneself. Freedom, Alva, freedom. You call that freedom, says Alva? She says, to ask nothing, to expect nothing, to depend on nothing. Dominique is a malevolent universer. This is Ayn Rand's own analysis. She holds the malevolent universe premise. Things are set against you. The good can't win. That's only for fairy tales and westerns. Crime does pay. The destruction is more common than construction or production. So she withdraws from the world. She learns better. That's why she's a heroine. And in the end, at the end of the novel, she acts completely on the benevolent universe premise. I think my picture has gone off. And I hope I'm back now. Let me see. Yeah, I'm back. This camera is somehow times out after 30 minutes. It's a Canon M50. And I think there's a way to defeat that if I search enough on the web, but I haven't got it yet. So Ayn Rand said that Dominique held the malevolent universe premise, and she learns through the course of the events of the novel, through Rourke's indefatigability, that means undefeatability, that the good can win, and that changes her. So at the end, she's a benevolent universer. But I said I advertised some other malevolent, negative, metaphysically negative movements and philosophies, and I want to mention them. Christianity, I've already covered. I want to quote Nietzsche, who's also malevolent, but he had a great attack on Christianity. He said, from the outset, Christianity spelled life loathing itself. What a great description. Sigmund Freud, atheist, modern guy. Sigmund Freud thinks that everything that's done is powered by instincts. That's the motive for everything. And instincts are negative. I'm quoting from Calvin Hall, a primer of Freudian psychology. He is a Freudian, so this is not like slanted against Freud. The final aim of an instinct is the removal of a bodily need. The removal of a bodily need. The aim of the instinct of hunger, for example, is to remove the physical condition of hunger. When this is done, no more bodily energy is released. The hunger instinct disappears, and the individual returns to a state of physiological and psychological quiescence. Some years ago, they sold a toy, which is a box. And if you flipped the switch on the box, a mechanical hand came up, flipped the switch back, and went back into the box, and it closed. That's Freud's view of life. That's the view of life of a lot of economists, unfortunately, including Ludwig von Mises, inconsistently. So Hall says, stated in another way, the aim of the instinct is to eliminate the source of that instinct. William James also said, the point of thought is to get rid of disease, dis-ease. Not disease, but dis-ease, unease. The aim of the pleasure principle, you've heard Freud maintain the pleasure principle, that surely that has to be a positive to get pleasure. The aim of the pleasure principle is to rid the person of tension. Or if this is impossible, as it usually is, to reduce the amount of tension to a low level and keep it as constant as possible. So when you're waiting for Apple to announce the new iPhone for the year, with bated breath, and you can hardly bear it, what you're trying to do is get rid of that eagerness. You're not trying to enjoy the cool features that might be, hopefully will be, in the new iPhone. You're just trying to get rid of that feeling of tension. There are no lengths that they won't go to maintain their negative, death-oriented motivation. Quiescence. Homeostasis is another word that gets it wrong, is based on this zero worshiping idea. Economic action is supposed to be to remove dissatisfaction. Not to achieve satisfaction, but to remove dissatisfaction. So the goal of everything is to get to the zero state, the state of death. You can get rid of all your tensions, instincts, diseases just by killing yourself. So it's implicitly advocating death. That's what I call death worshiping. Environmentalism, climate stasis they want. Save the planet. In other words, get rid of man. And one of them openly said, we can only wait for the next virus to come along and kill off 5/6 of mankind. They hate man's ability to improve on nature. They view any change introduced by man as bad because it's a change in the status quo, because it interferes with what is by necessity, by the laws of the physics, and imposes our choices on it. We shouldn't be worshiping the bitch goddess success. We shouldn't be going after anything. We should leave well enough alone, as one of them said. Now, I'll just end with Ayn Rand's counter statement. about all these philosophers from the Stoics on. You seek escape from pain. This is from Atlas Shrugged. We seek the achievement of happiness. You exist for the sake of avoiding punishment. We exist for the sake of earning rewards. Threats will not make us function. Fear is not our incentive. It is not death that we wish to avoid, but life that we wish to live. Thank you, and thank you, Ayn Rand. Daniel, are there any questions in the chat on this?
Yes, we have a question from Apollo Zeus. He's asking, why is Stoicism becoming popular again?
Why is Stoicism becoming popular again? Because people took William James's advice and got rid of the blind goddess, the bitch goddess success. I think environmentalism and climate change phobia are big things here. They've gotten the message, we shouldn't meddle. And there's a deeper thing, which I didn't cover and should have. These philosophers are anti-reason. Some openly, some by default, by failure to defend reason. These philosophers do not believe, they're determinists, and a determinist cannot believe that you, through thinking, can get the truth and change your life for the better. So if you think that, you're going to be miserable. And some of them who are caught in a traditional pursuit of success and this idea that you should leave well enough alone, you're just polluting the planet, you should stop exhaling and adding to the carbon dioxide level. I mean, they don't say that, but that's would be the logical implication. You should die. Lots of people should die and stop interfering. Our cities should be razed and turned into wilderness. All that makes them feel guilty, and the irrationality means that they can't sort anything out. That is the philosopher's teaching of reason is impotent, has destroyed the educational system, among other things. So people don't know anything, people can't cope. So if you're caught between a desire, maybe from your parents, to get ahead, to succeed, to make money, to make something of yourself, and a progressive education, this braining, this minding, as a friend calls it, you're going to seek a way out. And Stoicism offers that. It says, don't sweat it, nothing matters. You can achieve inner peace. Why do people talk about inner peace? Why do people meditate? They meditate because, I mean, not every last one of them, I'm going to utter a big generality. The cultural drive towards meditation comes from the fact that people are frightened. People are, quote, stressed, right? And that's why they meditate. But the stress is another word for anxiety. And anxiety comes, is inescapable. There's some anxiety that is earned or logical, but neurotic, pathological anxiety, anxiety without good explanation, good causing, is due to a fear you can't cope. What is imposter syndrome? So many successful people, particularly women, start to succeed and feel they're going to find me out. And this is like 40 years old, this term, imposter syndrome. They're going to find I'm a fraud. I can't do this. I'm not the big important person they think I am. I'm little me. And I'm head of this software firm, or I am head of the legal department here. I don't know what I'm doing. If you've got stress, you want inner peace. Unless you figure out that this is not the right way to conceptualize it at all, and what you want is the path to success through the proper use of your mind. But them days is gone. So I think it's due to the victory of Immanuel Kant, once again, in sabotaging people's ability to understand themselves, to think, to choose independent goals, and to use reason and logic successfully to achieve them and be happy. Is there another question?
We have a question from James. Could you do a show refuting Noam Chomsky?
Let me see if I can get that on my screen because I'm having a difficulty. Which one is this?
From James?
James Taylor?
Yes.
Could you do a show dismantling Noam Chomsky? I think it would go viral. Well, the show that I would do dismantling Noam Chomsky, who was at MIT when I went there, is attacking his linguistic ideas, his ideas in linguistics that propelled him to fame. His political ideas don't need attacking because they're too absurd to discuss. And I don't know if I'm qualified. I mean, I'm intellectually qualified, but I'd have to make a real study to dismantle his linguistics properly. I can take some quick shots at it. Maybe I'll do that in the next. Maybe we'll have a Q&A and do that next time. I see some other questions. How did the Enlightenment unravel so easily? Well, it wasn't easy. My God, the Enlightenment began in 1250. Well, no, I'm sorry. That's a precursor to the Renaissance with Thomas Aquinas. And the Enlightenment is usually dated from about 1600 to maybe 1783, the Reign of Terror and the French Revolution. It must not have been that solid to begin with, but that's 183 years. That's quite a stretch of time. It must not have been that solid to begin with. I'm amazed the lights still turn on. Yes, me too. It unraveled easily because there was an evil genius who found the feet of clay, so to speak, or the fatal flaw in Aristotle's defense of reason. And that was the absence of a theory of the relation of consciousness to existence, and particularly a theory of concept formation, and basically understanding. He didn't even have the concept consciousness. He had the concept perception, the concept emotion, the concept memory. He had all the major faculties of consciousness, but not consciousness qua consciousness. You know who formulated that concept? Nobody had it in his time. But you know who formulated that about 600 years later? Augustine, St. Augustine. So St. Augustine actually made a contribution to the history of the world along with his sick, twisted outpourings. There's some good in St. Augustine. I mean, in him personally. He's got a certain curiosity. If you read him, he's genuinely interested in solving some puzzles. But his main thrust, of course, was horrible black evil. So The answer is that there was a supremely skilled philosopher who wrote dense prose that convinced enough people to start spreading the poison. And what was his big thing? You remember from what was the trick? The fatal wrong premise that he introduced? Consciousness versus identity. The consciousness, because it's conscious somehow, isn't conscious. As Ayn Rand put it, that identity is the disqualifying element in consciousness. And no one until Ayn Rand put their finger on that and answered it. I see Abdullah. Well, let's put that, let's have a Q&A session. Because there are some other questions that are interesting here, and I want to answer them. So let's do that next Monday. It'll be another Ask Harry session where I'll take up questions that have already come in. And if you want to send me some, if they're at all interesting, I will answer them on the next show. Thanks and goodbye for now.